32-hour strike next month in an effort to secure a 26% pay rise. BBC News.
Read by Caroline Nichols. The Museum of Curiosity is throwing open its doors once more, and this time it's to actress Miriam Margolyes and comedian Chris McCausland. It's bound to be an interesting collection coming up next. And looking further ahead, a bit more wit and wisdom at this time on Thursday evening. The storyteller and satirist David Sedaris returns to Radio 4.
I thought I'd support the movement the way I had become accustomed to, by donating money and then telling people I'd donated twice as much.
The author shares his incisive humour and social critiques of modern life and himself.
The moment I got my first vaccine, I started thinking of the coronavirus the way I think of scurvy. Something from a long ago time, something that mainly pirates get.
A new series of Meet David Sedaris starts this Thursday evening at 6:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Now on Radio 4, John Lloyd returns with a brand new curator, Anna Tashinsky, to welcome you to the latest series of the Museum of Curiosity.
The Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd, and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Solent University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, where entry is universally and eternally free. We ask that you spend only time and pay only attention, although we now also accept contactless. To which end, let's meet someone who has never had a social media account and so is completely contactless. It's our brand new curator, poached from the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish, Anna Tashinsky.
Hello, John.
Hello, Anna, and welcome to the museum. Now, what do you hope to achieve in your tenure?
Well, I'm very excited to be here, and here is my plan. So the modern world is full of all this dreadful technology. I avoid it all, so we will be removing anything that I deem unnecessary.
Right, that explains why the Wi-Fi isn't working and why I can barely see you through the gloom.
Well, Professor, we're saving energy with candles.
Candle.
Exactly. Cost-effective and a little bit romantic. The epitome of this show, I think.
Yes. Well, let's begin our dark and arduous journey and meet this week's panel. Comedian Chris McCausland, entrepreneur Bill Liao, and actress Miriam Margolyes. Hello.
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 Chris, we've got quite a techie theme today, and you're a tech and gadget fan. How can you convince me, a phobe, to care about them?
I think the trick is to imagine how awful your life would be without all of your modern gadgets, but then also to completely ignore how much better your life would be without all of your modern gadgets.
Bill, you're pretty techie, and you certainly invest in environmentally friendly tech companies. Do you pay them in green cryptocurrency?
Yeah, we love to pay in vapor, but most of them are smart enough not to accept vapor. So we actually have to use cash.
Miriam, would you say you're a high-tech or a low-tech model?
I think I'm low-tech, but I'm an aspiring high-tech. I always want to do more than I can, and that's why I get in a muddle on the computer.
OK, you're ready for the upgrade.
I'm not going to Windows 11. I've got to draw the line somewhere.
So coming to you first, Chris, you're a regular on TV panel shows like Would I Lie to You and something called QI. You're currently touring your new stand-up show, Speaky Blinder, great title. You present Radio 4's You Heard It Here First, have appeared on the Royal Variety Performance and won Celebrity Mastermind.
Yeah, but I'm not the academic, John, so I did 90s grunge rockers Pearl Jam.
Is that a real group?
Yeah.
I've never heard of them.
It's a rude name, is it? Is it like 10cc?
No, it's not. That's one of those myths.
I'd never heard the rude thing, and now I'm desperately internally speculating as to what is rude about Pearl Jam.
I want to know what's rude about 10cc.
It's a certain volume of liquid, Miriam.
Do you mean sperm? Well, I'm unfamiliar with sperm. I haven't seen sperm since the First World War, so I don't really know much about it.
Chris, is it right that you used to have a guide dog and it was really bad at doing its job?
I did, yeah, because I'm obviously blind. I don't just collect bizarre kind of niche animals.
Sure.
I have an emotional regulation parrot as well. I had quite a boisterous dog, which I was told was necessary if I ever wanted to go into London with him. But the boisterousness gave him this massive sense of power and independence. So we just kind of really went where he wanted to go. If he saw something on the floor he liked the look of, that's where we were heading, which really wasn't what you want, you want from a guide dog. And he got his license revoked.
Are you blind, Chris?
I am, Miriam, yeah.
Oh, God, I am sorry. I didn't know that.
That's okay. It wasn't your fault.
No, it really wasn't. I wouldn't want to be responsible for that.
Did I read something that your wife's Brazilian?
Yes.
Do you speak Portuguese?
No, I've tried, but she told me to stop because she said it was like talking to a toddler, because she'd come home from work and I'd just be like, I've got a hat!
So, Chris, you're also something of an international man of mystery because you were once nearly recruited to MI5. How did that happen?
Before I got into stand-up, I was just applying for all kinds of jobs. People might think that to be in MI5, you've got to like solve a particularly difficult kind of Sudoku puzzle in the back of a magazine, but they just have a graduate scheme. And I applied and there was 3,000 applicants and I got down to the last 30 before they came to their senses.
Did they fail you on sniper training?
Almost, yeah. It was because of my eyesight that they said no. Which is, I think, a perfectly acceptable form of discrimination.
I've been a spy for a private detective. I had to wear a wire and pretend to be somebody who was looking for a nurse for my father. This person I was interviewing had pretended to be qualified as a nurse, and my job was to get her to say that she was qualified as a nurse.
Wow. And did you manage, Miriam? Did you succeed?
Of course I did. It is kind of acting, isn't it? And I quite enjoyed it.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Chris. You may not have become a spy, but every time I've seen you perform, it's pretty clear you have a license to kill. Now, Bill, you're a social networking pioneer, biotech investor, philanthropic entrepreneur, educator, author, and speaker. You're a Chinese Australian who serves as a special diplomatic envoy for St. Kitts and Nevis, has planted millions of trees all over the world and lives in Ireland. As a passionate environmentalist, how do you get around?
So I made a stupid promise not to fly until we planted 100 million trees. So for best part of 15 years, I got around with boats and trains and walking. You know, I was representing St. Kitts and Nevis at the COP15, I think it was, in Denmark. I'd done my carbon calculations and everything looked very good living on an organic farm with solar power and everything. But I had 3 million frequent flyer miles. And so I gave up flying. And I was, my first major trek was to get to Denmark from Ireland. There's quite a lot of virtue signaling goes on and quite a lot of snobbery goes on in the environmental area of the COP at the time. And, you know, they'd sort of ask you, oh, well, you know, what's your carbon footprint? And I'd go, well, actually, now it's pretty neutral. And they say, well, how did you achieve that? Well, I don't fly anymore until we plant 100 million trees. And that shut them up pretty quick. And we did plant 100 million trees. We funded the 100 millionth in the pandemic. So now I'm flying again.
Did you enjoy taking sort of presumably very long haul ferry trips everywhere? Was it quite a meditative thing having to slow down so much?
I wrote some books on the move. There were some beautiful moments, like the occasional thing, like in the middle of the Atlantic, in midnight, looking up at the stars. Mm.
So tell me, what's the organization that plants all these trees?
It's called We Forest, because that's literally what we do, and I like names that do what they say.
I mean, sticking to spies, you could have at least said special branch.
don't make me fall off the twig. Oh, God. Miriam just died a little inside
just
there.
Just a little.
We figured out two important things. One, trees make clouds. So if you plant a lot of them, you cool the planet faster than just the carbon. And the other thing is, it's better to have a tree worth more alive to local people than dead. We set things up such that the local people derive income from the food forests that we help them plant. You want it so that the village women will cut the nuts off any man who tries to cut their nut trees down.
That's great. Well, thank you, Bill. Changing the world 100 million trees at a time. And to encourage everyone else to contribute to your amazing We Forest project, I'd like to remind them of the old saying, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is now. So, Miriam, your career spans 5 decades in film, television, theatre and video games.
And radio.
Oh, yes.
I started in radio, Wait. Darling, and it looks as if I'm going to finish there, I might say.
I'll read that again.
Why read it again? Why don't you keep that in? I think it's charming. It's your programme. Go ahead.
No, it isn't my programme. I'm just the robot puppet manipulated by those people you can't see. Keep it in, he says. Right. But anyway, Miriam, among many standout moments, you were Professor Sprout in Harry Potter, Sister Mildred in Call the Midwife, and most memorably for me personally, the Spanish Infanta, Lady Whiteadder and Queen Victoria in 3 separate incarnations of Blackadder. You've won a BAFTA for Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence and written a hilariously frank autobiography, and I mean that, this much is true. You've portrayed nurses, midwives and professors. Would you say you have a naturally nurturing side?
No, I don't think I have. I'm an actress, for goodness sake. I like acting, caring, but I'm not a carer. I care about people and I care that we live in such an awful society and people are so cruel to each other and particularly to immigrants and people coming from abroad and people who don't fit in. I care to make things better, but individually I can't put on elastoplast and wipe out anuses. I just can't.
Do you do jokes?
No, I hate jokes. Actually, I hate comedy. I was quite depressed when I heard that one of our guests is a comedian.
Can't stand acting either.
No, well, there you are, you see. People who make a living out of comedy, that must be so desperate.
Well, you've got one thing right. I am desperate.
Me too, darling.
So, finally, Miriam, you've also made documentaries on obesity, death and sexuality. Is there any subject left you'd like to tackle?
Yes, there is. Israel and Palestine. I would love to be able to do a documentary in Israel and in Palestine, but the BBC won't let me.
Are they worried you'll make the problem worse?
I think probably they think I will be murdered.
Well, we wouldn't want that. Absolutely not.
Are you sure?
No, definitely not, Miriam. You are a blooming national treasure and it's lovely to be with you. But thank you, Miriam. We are so pleased to have you here in the museum with us and thanks for keeping it clean so far.
I've done my best.
So, Chris, I was going to ask you something. Personal question.
Yes.
Do you know which type of retinitis pigmentosa you have?
I've been told it was inverse cone rod dystrophy.
Right. When were you told that?
Oh, so long ago. I was probably a teenager.
I would definitely get a specific screen for P56 and P50, I think it is. Mutation.
I mean, you able to tell this from looking at me?
No. It's just that they do screens now that are very specific for the condition. The eye doesn't have an immune system the same as the rest of the body. So if you do a genetic therapy in the eye, it won't get rejected. So if you can find out your specific mutation, there's actually a whole new ray of hope that's just happened in the last few years.
Wow, Bill, I mean, you've already made me feel useless. I can't have your cure in my eyesight as well. Just give it a rest, man.
Well, I did my research and I was looking up the clinical trials and I spent a lot of time with geneticists.
So, I would like to learn more about this,
mate. You mean you come on this programme and you can cure blindness? My God.
He's decided he's never going to use his eyes again until he cures 100 million blind people.
And now, can we open the vault, please, Anna?
Mother's maiden name, please.
What?
Well, how do I know you're the real John Lloyd?
All right, Turnpenny.
Okay, you've just made that up. So let's try a new tack. Who is a better host of QI, Stephen Fry or Sandy Toksvig?
Well, they're both equally brilliant.
Yep, that's the John Lloyd I know. Mother's maiden name, Bootlicker. Okay. I now declare the museum open for donations. So, Chris, what would you like to donate to the museum?
I would like to donate the vinyl record.
Ooh.
And why is it that you would like to donate that?
I'm such a music fan. I love music. And I'm also a geek. You know, I love technology and I do depend on a lot of technology, but I don't like how almost disposable and insignificant music has become compared to what it was really when you had to physically own it and look after it and put it on with your hands and listen to it in the order it was intended. And I think music should have to take up space. It gives it more of a value.
Well, that is brilliantly explained. I completely agree. I think that we have such a connection to physical things. It's like reading a physical book, isn't it? It's such a different experience.
About how many records have you got, Chris?
I've no idea, because a lot of them I've been ordered to put in storage until we move somewhere bigger. Thousands, let's say.
Miriam, do you collect anything interesting?
I collect political cartoons of the 19th century, especially fat ladies.
Do you collect printouts of these things, or do you collect original copies of them from that time?
Original copies.
Because that's the lovely thing, isn't it? It's like holding a piece of history,
yes,
in your hand. There's that thing of having the original pressing of something.
Oh, yes, wonderful.
Something about vinyl that I find really interesting is that when it was first coming about, no one here would have been allowed to own a vinyl in America except Chris. Do you know about this, Chris?
No.
It was legal for anyone, except if you were blind, to own a vinyl record. And I think it was about 1933 to 1948. And it was because they could listen to audiobooks on them. And so you didn't listen to music, but they would get free audiobooks. And once you'd listened, you sent it back and it was sent on to the next person. And they had to sign a contract with all authors saying they promised that they would never let people who could see have access to these vinyl records.
Wow. And you see, I am a massive audiobook junkie, but I can't imagine anything more tedious than having to listen to an unabridged book on vinyl.
Well, Chris, do you have a favourite? Because we have to display this in the museum. So how do you intend to get this displayed? Is it going to be one vinyl?
Well, as you know, it's impossible to pick a favourite, because the thing with music is it depends on mood, doesn't it? So what I'm hoping for is my own rather substantial room within the museum where I can move my entire vinyl collection out of storage.
That's ideal.
Have it displayed around the edges with a lovely armchair in the middle, preferably a lock on the inside of the door and a good sound system. And it'll give me somewhere to go, really, to...
It's less of a museum and just more of a home away from home that we're building for you then at this stage.
I'm a little bit upset that you've seen through my facade.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. We are happy to record your donation vinyl-y.
Right, Bill, what exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
I am donating a Drosophila melanogaster. It's a common fruit fly. It's a very uncommon fruit fly at the same time. And if you think going after blindness was the piece de resistance, well, sorry to disappoint. These fruit flies have been modified with the genetic mutations of a young man's appendicitic cancer. So the interesting thing is 90% of the cancer mutations in human cancers are actually conserved from fruit flies. So it's the exact same mutation in the fruit flies as in patient's tumour. You know, in cancer, a lot of the time, oncologists are afraid to give multiple drugs to treat cancer at the same time because a lot of those drugs are very dangerous. And whenever you get cancer and you get that chemotherapy treatment, a lot of that time, it's kind of you're a clinical trial of one, because they test the drug on you. They say, okay, you get this drug, and then they look to see if the cancer responds. What's happened here with this is that these fruit flies have the cancer, and they have been given hundreds of thousands of different drug combinations. And the ones I'm holding here, the precise drug combination included a chemotherapy drug, a psoriasis drug, included one other drug. And so the trial was done on the flies and not on the patient. And the patient's oncologist was then given a recommendation of the three drugs that worked not to kill the cancer, but to keep the flies alive. That combination is actually being given to the patient right now, and I'm very pleased to say that the tumour in the patient is responding far more effectively than what was proposed as the standard of care.
Astonishing.
Well, I'm glad I got to go first. Glad I didn't have to follow a cure for cancer with the vinyl record.
All part of life's rich pattern.
I did apologise ahead of time.
Good luck, Miriam.
I'm just thrilled that this is happening, that you're doing something like this. I've never heard of fruit flies helping in cancer cures.
I mean, this is the result of 15 years of research at Mount Sinai Medical Centre. The amazing thing is that we share so many genes with so many different organisms. I mean, we are just not that far different from a fruit fly or a mouse. It's just that with specific cancers, specific mutations, you have to do a lot of different tests to come up with a specific therapy combination. And like, this was unfeasible previously. Like, if you did it with mice, imagine trying to keep alive 400,000 different mice. That's not going to work. 400,000 fruit flies, on the other hand, is actually easy to do. And with modern liquid handling robots, dosing them with the different drugs is actually very straightforward.
So, Chris, it seems a bit banal, but do you have a relationship with the insect world or flies of any kind?
No, I mean, I just don't like any of them. I mean, obviously, I mean, I appreciate their value. I mean, this sounds amazing, to be honest, doesn't it? But I'm not great with tiny little things. I think because I imagine them in my head rather than looking at them, and I imagine them probably a lot worse than what they actually are.
One thing that is a bit frightening about fruit flies is their sperm can be, I think, 2 inches long. So their sperm is 1,000 times bigger than elephant sperm and 20 times the length of their own body.
Where do they keep it?
I think it's rolled up, so it's like a ball of yarn.
Or oh, it's then... more like a party blower.
Exactly.
Who knew?
Explosive sperm.
Precisely. Bill, how would you like to display it? Do you want it to be one fruit fly alone, drugged up to the eyeballs with 3,000 different types of cancer drug, lots of fruit flies? How should we do this?
So this is fly 427. Mm-hmm. It's actually a little vial, and it's got their food source in it, which is fruit, obviously. And the fruit is laced with the drugs that are keeping them alive, and they're living very happily and healthily. So we just have to occasionally top it up with a little bit of the food, and they can continue to live their life cycles.
Brilliant. Chris, maybe we could put it in your vinyl room and you could do the fruit fly feeding.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like it's going to take up much space, does it? So, I mean, if anything, this gives me the opportunity to do something slightly more worthy with my life.
There you go.
Bill, thank you for your really extraordinary donation. I mean, who knew fruit flies could cure cancer? If we got them 400,000 tiny spades, maybe you could teach them to plant trees as well.
So, Miriam, what would you like to give to the museum?
I want to give something that means a lot to me. It's actually a person and his output, and it is Charles Dickens.
Ah, talk to us about your love for Charles Dickens then. When did the love affair begin?
The love affair began when I was 11 and I read Oliver Twist when I was at the Oxford High School. I knew straight away that I had been pulled into an extraordinary world, a world that I knew was very like the world that we all live in, but somehow charged and different and brighter and busier. I think he's an extraordinary creature, and he is really the way that we see the 19th century. He was also able to create over 2,000 characters and be funny and be wicked at the same time.
Absolutely.
And for me, he is the greatest writer, greater than Shakespeare, greater than anybody that ever lived. And I can't think of a better thing that I could give to the museum.
Well, I can sort of be reminded of him in you a little bit, because he was, well, first of all, I can see you portraying so many Dickens characters so brilliantly.
Yeah,
and true. Secondly, you're very good at voices, and he liked to perform his works, didn't he? He would tour the world reading his books aloud. He thought they should be, you know, performed to a mass.
Oh, yes. When he was writing, he used to put down his pen and rush to the mirror and act in front of the mirror.
Well, I found an interesting thing that Dickens saw all his characters as if they were real and heard them speak all their dialogue, and he claims he never actually invented any of them. And I always think that's a very good thing. It's when you're channeling.
Yes, completely.
As you said, he's created over 2,000 characters, I think, and I don't know why I'm asking this because I couldn't possibly choose, but do you have a favourite among them?
It's really difficult to do that, but the two that I love very much, two very different women. One is Mrs. Gamp from Martin Chuzzlewit, who's a drunken old midwife, and Miss Havisham.
I think Martin Chuzzlewit's one of my favourites, and I wrote down so many Mrs. Gamp quotes. There's one that goes, "The face of Mrs. Gamp, the nose in particular, was somewhat red and swollen, and it was difficult to enjoy her society without becoming conscious of a smell of spirits." But every detail about her is stunning.
His names also. I love funny names. And before plumping for the title Martin Chuzzlewit, he toyed with Martin Sweetledew, Martin Sweetleback, Martin Sweetlewag, and Martin Chuzzletoe.
Well, I mean, speaking of his excellent imagination for names and names that befit their characters, Chris, if you were to have a Dickensian name, what sort of traits would it convey? What would the name be?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'd hate for Miriam to think any lower of me, but I've never read a book by Charles Dickens. I've learnt a lot in the last 5 minutes, so I reckon I'd probably go with something that corresponds to what I tend to be covered in a lot of the time. So I'd probably go for Chris Pringle Crumb.
You've got it. You've got the measure of him.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Well, he did have a Mr. Crisp Sparkle.
Oh, did he?
That was one of his names. But, you know, Chris, I don't think less of you because you haven't read Dickens, but I would love you to have a go.
I would love you to tell me which one to read, and I will get it on audiobook.
I would just go for A Christmas Carol. Take it slowly, skip where you get bored, but you will enjoy it.
Okay.
It's rich. It's delicious and very moving as well. So I think you're in for a treat. Please, please do that.
100% give that a go.
Bill, if Charles Dickens were alive today, what kind of issues do you think he'd be writing about?
You know, if he was alive today and he didn't have his previous body of work, I could imagine him recreating A Tale of Two Cities, but with, you know, almost any of the immigrant stories that are there today. I mean, you know, as an immigrant myself and having moved across cultures and witnessing that with my dad moving and my mum moving across cultures, yeah, I relate to Charles Darnay. I think Dickens would find an enormously rich characterization of the joy and the misery of the life of the immigrant.
I think you're right, Bill. I think he would write about the immigrant experience. Can I just share another one of my favorite quotes in his migrant experience, which was largely based in America, where he traveled? And I think Dickens was appalled at American eating habits and the fact that they ate quite voraciously. And he's depicts one dinner where he says, "The poultry disappeared as rapidly as if every bird had had the use of its wings and had flown in desperation down a human throat."
Yes. No, he wrote like a king, and he didn't like America. It is not the republic of my imagination.
Well, Miriam, now that we've got our hands on Dickens, how would you like us to display him?
After all that romance, what are you going to do with his corpse?
We can bring it back
I
to
don't
life.
I don't think of him as a corpse. He lives. He lives in all our imaginations, in our memories. Actually, rather like Chris, I'd like him in his study, at his desk, with a pen in his hand.
And on the page he's writing on, if it could just say, "Chris Pringle Crumb was a desperate comedian."
It's a good opener.
It really is.
Well, Miriam, thank you for your generous donation of Charles Dickens.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much. So, there we have it. The museum's collection now includes The Creator of Oliver Twist, What Twist and Shout Came Out On, and some fruit flies to really shout about. Well, thank you, Chris, Bill and Miriam. My respect to you all as people who've really made something of your lives. In the immortal words of Charles Dickens himself, this is a world of action and not for moping and droning in. That's all from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Anna Duchinsky. The donors were Bill Yao, Miriam Margulies and Chris McCausland. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Turner, Mandy Fenton, Jade Gebby, Cameron Loxdale and Lydia Meisen. The producers were Sam Holmes and Lieing Lee, and it was a BBC Studios production for Radio 4.
And John and Anna will be back at the same time next week. Susan has a surprise for Alice. We're off to Ambridge after the news. Then Front Row talks to actor Hugh Jackman about his role in the new film The Sun. That's coming up at 20 past seven here on BBC Radio 4.
On BBC iPlayer. Six robbers have carried out an armed raid, stealing almost 3 tons of gold.
Inspired by Britain's biggest gold heist.
How do you shift 3 tons of gold?
Slowly.
£26 million worth of pure gold in the possession of people who didn't expect to have it.
If you could handle a job like this, then I'd have heard of you.
You only hear about the people who get caught.
Stealing it was just the start.
We're looking for 6 robbers and 3 tons of gold. Every ring, every watch. If you're looking for the gold, it's all around you.
The Gold. Watch on BBC iPlayer.